Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob. I'm reading today from the story of John G. Peyton, the missionary to the South Sea Island Cannibals in islands formerly known as the New Hebrides, now the nation of Vanuatu. We're on chapter 49. It's called The Aborigines of Australia. Detained for nearly a week at Balmoral by the breakdown of the coach on these dreadful roads, I telegraphed to Hamilton for a conveyance, and the superintendent of the Sunday school, a dear Mr. Laidlaw, volunteered, in order to reduce expenses, to spend one day of his precious time coming for me and another driving me down. While awaiting him, I came into painful and memorable contact with the Aborigines of Australia. The publicans had organized a day of sports, horse racing, and circus exhibitions. Immense crowds assembled, and amongst the rest, tribe after tribe of the Aborigines from all the surrounding country. Despite the law prohibiting the giving of strong drinks to these poor creatures, foolish and unprincipled dealers supplied them with the same, and the very blankets which the government had given them were freely exchanged for the firewater which kindled them to madness. Next day was the Sabbath. The morning was hideous with the yells of the fighting savages. They tore about on the common in front of the church, leading gentlemen having tried in vain to quiet them, and their wild voices without jarred upon the morning service. About 2 o'clock I tried to get into conversation with them. I appealed to them whether they were not all tired and hungry. They replied that they had had no food all that day. They had fought since the morning. I said, "I love you, black fellows. I go missionary black fellows far away. I love you. Want you rest. Get food. Come, all of you, rest. Sit round me. We will talk until till the women get ready tea. They boil water. I take tea with you, and then you be strong." By broken English and by many symbols, I won their ear. They produced tea and damper, that is, a rather forbidding-looking bread, without yeast, baked on the coals. Their wives hasted to boil water. I kept incessantly talking to interest them and told them how Jesus, God's dear Son, came and died to make them happy, and how he grieved to see them beating and fighting and killing each other. When the tea was ready, we squatted on the green grass. Their tins were filled, the damper was broken into lumps, and I asked the blessing of God on the meal. To me it was unpleasant eating. Many of them looked strong and healthy, but not a few were weak and dying creatures. The strong, devouring all they could get, urged me to be done and let them finish their fighting, eager for the fray. But having gained their confidence, I prayed with them, and thereafter said, "Now, before I leave, I will ask of you to do one thing for my sake, which you can all easily do." And with one voice they replied, "Yes, we all do whatever you say." I got their leaders to promise to me one by one. I then said, "Now, you have got your tea, and I ask every man and boy among you to lie down in the bush and take a sleep. And your wives will sit by and watch over your safety." In glum silence, their war weapons still grasped in their hands, they stood looking intently at me, doubting whether I could be in earnest. I urged them, "You all promised to do what I asked. If you break your promise, these white men will laugh at me and say that blackfellows only lie and deceive. Let them see that you can be trusted. I wait here till I see you all asleep." One said that his head was cut and he must have revenge before he could lie down. Others filed past showing their wounds and declaring that it was too bad to request them to go to sleep. I praised them as far as I could, but I urged them for once to be men and to keep their word. Finally, they all agreed to lie down, I waiting till the last man had disappeared. And being doubly exhausted with the debauch and the fighting, they were soon all fast asleep. I prayed that the blessed sleep might lull their savage passions. Before daylight next morning, the minister and I were hastening to the scene to prevent further fighting. But as the sun was rising, we saw the last tribe of the distant natives disappearing over the brow of a hill. A small party belonging to the district alone remained. They shouted to us, "Black fellows all gone! No more fight! You too much like black fellow." For 3 days afterward, I had still to linger there, and if their dogs ran or barked at me, the women chased them with sticks and stones and protected me. One little touch of kindness and sympathy had unlocked their darkened hearts. Who wonders that the dark races melt away before the whites? The pioneers of civilization will carry with them this demon of strong drink, the fruitful parent of every other vice. The black people drink and become unmanageable, and through the white man's own poison gift, an excuse is found for sweeping the poor creatures off the face of the earth. Marsden's writings show how our Australian blacks are destroyed. But I have myself been on the track of such butcheries again and again. A Victorian lady told me the following incident. She heard a child's pitiful cry in the bush, and on tracing it, she found a little girl weeping over her younger brother. She said, "The white men poisoned our father and mother. They threatened to shoot me so that I dare not go near them. I am here, weeping over my brother, till we die." The compassionate lady promised to be a mother to the little sufferers and to protect them. They instantly clung to her and have proved themselves to be loving and dutiful ever since. Chapter 50. Nora is the name of this chapter. Nora. While I was pondering over Kingsley's words about the blacks of Australia being poor brutes in human shape and too low to take in the gospel, the story of Nora, an Aboriginal Christian woman, whom I myself actually visited and corresponded with, was brought under my notice, as if to shatter to pieces everything that the famous preacher had proclaimed. A dear friend told me how he had seen Nora encamped with the blacks near Hexham in Victoria. Her husband had lost, through drink, their once comfortable home at a station where he was employed. The change back to life in camp had broken her health, and she lay sick on the ground within a miserable hut. The visitor found her reading a Bible and explaining to a number of her own poor people the wonders of redeeming love. My friend, Roderick Urquhart, Esquire, overcome by the sight, said, "Nora, I am grieved to see you here, and deprived of every comfort in your sickness." She answered, not without tears, "The change has indeed made me unwell, but I am beginning to think that this too is far the best. It has at last brought my poor husband to his senses, and I will grudge nothing if God thereby brings him to the Savior's feet." She further explained that she had found wonderful joy in telling her own people about the true God and his son Jesus, and was quite assured that the Lord in his own way would send her relief. The visitors who accompanied Mr. Urquhart showed themselves to be greatly affected by the true and pure Christian spirit of this poor Aboriginal, and on parting she said, "Do not think that I like this miserable hut or the food or the company, but I am and have been happy in trying to do good amongst my people." Well, for my part, let that dear Christ-like soul look out on me from her Aboriginal hut, and I will trample underfoot all teachings or theorizings that dare to say that she or her kind are but poor brutes as mere blasphemies against human nature. I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. It is easy to understand how even experienced travelers may be deluded to believe that the Aborigines have no idols and no religion. One must have lived amongst them or their kindred ere he can authoritatively decide these questions. Before I left Melbourne, for instance, I had met Nathaniel Pepper, a converted Aboriginal from Wimmera. I asked him if his people had any doctors, that is, sacred men or priests. He said they had. I inquired if they had any objects of worship or any belief in God. He said, no, none whatever. But on taking from my pocket some 4 small stone idols, his expression showed at once that he recognized them as objects of worship. He had seen the sacred men use them, but he refused to answer any more questions. I resolved now, if possible, to secure some of their idols and set this whole problem once for all at rest. At Newstead, on another occasion, I persuaded a whole camp of the Aborigines to come to my meeting. After the address, they waited to examine the idols and stone gods which I had shown. Some of the young men admitted that their doctors had things like these, which they and the old people prayed to. But they added jauntily, "We young fellows don't worship. We know too much for that." No doctors were, however, in that camp, so I could not meet with them. But I already felt that the testimony of nearly all white people that the blacks had no idols and no worship was quickly crumbling away. On returning to Horsham, from a visit to a great camp of the blacks at Wawanda, and having purchased in the presence of witnesses specimens of their idols from the doctor or sacred man of these tribes, I informed my dear friends, Reverend P. Simpson and his excellent lady, of my exploits and possessions. He replied, "There is a black doctor gone round our house just now to see one of his people who is washing here today. Let's go and test them, whether they know these objects." Carrying them in his hand, we went to them. The woman, instantly on perceiving them, dropped what she was washing and turned away in instinctive terror. Mr. Simpson asked, "Have you ever before seen stones like these?" The wily doctor replied, "Plenty on the plains, where I kicked them out of my way." Taking others out of my pocket, I said, "These make people sick and well, don't they?" His rage overcame his duplicity, and he exclaimed, "What black fellow gave you these? If I know him, I do for him." The woman, looking the picture of terror and pointing to one of the objects, cried, "That fellow no good. He kill men. No good, no good. Me too much afraid." Then looking at me, she said, pointing with her finger, "That fellow savvy, he knows too much. No white men see them. He no good." There was more in this scene and in all its surroundings than in many arguments, and Mr. Simpson thoroughly believed that these were objects of idolatrous worship. And now let me relate the story of my visit to Nora, the converted Aboriginal referred to above. Accompanied by Robert Hood, Esquire, J.P., Victoria, I found my way to the encampment near Hexham. She did not know of our coming, nor see us till we stood at the door of her hut. She was clean and tidily dressed, as were also her dear little children, and appeared glad to see us. She had just been reading the Presbyterian Messenger, and the Bible was lying at her elbow. I said, "Do you read the Messenger?" She replied, "Yes, I like to know what is going on in the church." We found her to be a sensible and humble Christian woman, conversing intelligently about religion and serving God devotedly. Next Sabbath, she brought her husband, her children, and 6 blacks to church, all decently dressed, and they all listened most attentively. At our first meeting, I said, "Nora, they tell me you are a Christian. I want to ask you a few questions about the blacks, and I hope that as a Christian, you will speak the truth." Rather hurt at my language, she raised her right hand and replied, "I am a Christian. I fear and serve the true God. I always speak the truth." Taking from my pocket the stone idols from the islands, I inquired if her people had or worshipped things like these. She replied, "The doctors have them." "Do you have a doctor in your camp?" I asked. She said, "Yes, my uncle is the sacred man, but he is now far away from this." "Has he the idols with him now?" I inquired. She answered, "No, they are left in my care." I then said, "Could you let us see them?" She consulted certain representatives of the tribe who were at hand. They rose and removed to a distance. They had consented. Mr. Hood assured me that no fault would be found with her, as she was the real, or at least virtual, head of the tribe. Out of a larger bag, she then drew two smaller bags and opened them. They were filled with the very objects which I had brought from the islands. I asked her to consult the men of her tribe whether they would agree to sell 4 or 5 of them to me, that I might by them convince the white people that they had gods of their own, and are therefore above the brutes of the field. The money to be given to their sacred man on his return. This also, after a time, was agreed to. I selected 3 of the objects, and I paid the stipulated price. And I have the recorded testimony of Robert Hood, J.P., ex Hexham, Victoria, 28th February, 1863, certifying on his honor all that I am here affirming. Mr. Hood asked Nora how he had never heard of or seen these things before, living so long amongst them, and blacks constantly coming and going about his house. She replied, "Long ago, white men laughed at black fellows praying to their idols. Black fellows said, 'White men never see them again.' Suppose this white man not know all about them, he would not now see them. No white men live now have seen what you have seen." Thus it has been demonstrated on the spot and in presence of the most reliable witnesses that the aborigines, before they saw the white invaders, were not brutes incapable of knowing God, but human beings yearning after a god of some kind. Nor do I believe that any tribe of men will ever be found who, when their language and customs are rightly interpreted, will not display their consciousness of the need of a god, and the divine capacity of holding fellowship with the unseen powers, of which the brutes are without one faintest trace. Poor, dear, Christian-hearted Nora, the Christ Spirit shines forth unmistakably through thee, praying for us and seeking to save husband and children, enduring trials and miseries by the aid of communion with thy Lord, weeping over the degradation of thy people, and seeking to lift them up by telling them of the true God and of his love to mankind through Jesus Christ. Next time, chapter 51, we go back to Scotland, back to Scotland. Thank you for listening. I do like hearing from you. Please contact me with questions and comments at bob.j.falconer.72@gmail.com. And look around the site while you're here. I do believe you're going to find much that will be beneficial. Readings from great preachers, stories from the persecuted church, Bible studies, and a lot more. And we have audios twice daily now, Monday to Friday, 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. Chicago time, if you're in real time with us. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun, and Lord willing, we'll talk again real soon. Bye-bye.